This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State, Apple Podcast number ones throughout the world. Subscribe now and tell your friends.
I was just still a bit shaken because it was more of a row, really. And people were trying to pull him away from me. And, you know, credit to him that he did say, no, it's fine. Because actually, I think he ended up staying much longer than he was meant to. And we were probably talking for a good 5-6 minutes. But it's quite scary when you confront someone, when you have a row with anybody, let alone one of the most famous faces in the country.
If I'd been asked which journalist might confront Gary Lineker face-to-face about his views on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and his tweets about it, I might well have said, it's going to be Nicole Lampert. And so it was, as Nicole and a small handful of other journalists were invited to a Broadcasting Press Guild lunch to hear from Lineker about his burgeoning podcast business. The rest is politics with Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart. The rest is history with Tom Holland and Dominic Sandbrook. And the rest is football with his Match of the Day chums are among the most downloaded titles in the UK market. The press all introduced themselves, and Gary admitted, I feel scared now. And he was right too. He'd retweeted a BDS demand to ban Israel from international football, but he took it down later. And as you'll hear, Nicole asked him why he'd broken the BBC's social media guidelines with that, if he knew them so well. Apparently, he helped write them. He claimed that it was a news story, but Nicole wouldn't let it lie. She said it was a demand, and therefore it broke the rules. The BBC did nothing, apparently. The usually polite and deferential event suddenly took a turn. And there was clapping at the end of Gary's presentation, but Nicole didn't join in the applause, and Gary went to look for her. Does she think she has laid a glove on Gary? Pricked his conscience? Nicole takes up the story with me.
Well done for what you did.
Thank you. Good on him for coming to talk to me. Didn't have to. So, you know, there is that. And I know what it's like to have a massive Twitter pile on. When I saw the event was coming up, I thought, okay, well, I better go and see if I can get anything. I thought I might get a single line out of him. You know, I did hope to kind of make him stop and think. But then actually, I did ask him this question in the Q&A, and it was about the Israeli football team and about how it was a retweet from the BDS organization calling for them to be banned. And I did ask him, because he talked just a minute earlier about how he'd helped draw up the guidelines, and I'd asked him about breaking the BBC guidelines, and he said no, it wasn't. And I said yes, it was. And it was a bit of back and forth, and the person running the Q&A wasn't very happy with me, and she's like, what is your question? Because he said it was a news story, and I said no, it wasn't, it was a demand. And he said no, it was a news story, no, it was a demand. And then that kind of went off, because he basically kept saying it was a news story, and I kept saying it was a demand. And he said, well, I wasn't breaking the guidelines because it was a news story. And then he said no one from the BBC came and talked to me, which was also astounding, because so many people from the Jewish community had written to the BBC saying this is outrageous.
Yeah, this is the thing. This was supposed to be a polite affair, a press guild event. The idea that we can celebrate his business, though, it seems most odd to me. I mean, really, what was the pretext for this? He must have known that, you know, he's not as loved as he used to be, and that there's a big risk to these events for someone like him now.
I don't know. I think I think he probably lives in a bubble, and I think that's part of his problem, that he lives in this bubble of people that say yes to him. And I think that's maybe why I quite surprised him. And obviously, you know, he likes to have a go at the Mail, and there were two, you know, I'm a freelancer, I write a lot for the Mail, but there were two actual Mail colleagues that were there. And we know that he likes to give it out to the Mail, but, you know, I don't know whether he maybe thought, I'm trying to think. I mean, there's probably just an element where he genuinely believes he's right, and that's the thing. He doesn't believe he's broken any guidelines because he believes he wrote the guidelines.
Did he write them through pressure, or did he actually physically sit in Tim Davies' offices with him and said, look, no, we can't be having that?
Yeah. Well, the BBC, you know, they have said that was it James Harding. He did speak to a lot of people, and of course the guidelines were only being rewritten because of Gary's behaviour, and that whole thing with saying the words about the immigration laws that was akin to 1930s Germany, and the fuss that had caused, and him being suspended, and then people from Much of the Day walking out. So the guidelines, most people that work at the BBC are pretty clear on the guidelines. And you know, there is this irony that I know at least two journalists who have been reprimanded for openly having a go at Gary Lineker on Twitter. So it doesn't go both ways. So they're not allowed to have a go at him, but he's allowed to have a go at whoever he wants.
It's the progressive hierarchy, isn't it, Nicole? That's how things work in the modern day BBC, it appears. But let me ask you here, this was intended to be an event where he could present himself in a way that probably Lineker would have been able to have presented himself up to about 5 years ago. It wasn't able to be. And then you were the stummer in the crowd, because at the end of the speech, apparently you didn't applaud with the rest of the gang. He came to look for you in the cloakrooms after the event and said, oh, what's happening? And, you know, this big celebrity is going off for a journalist to find out, oh, don't you like me? What happened then? There's more to this.
It was a bit, don't you like me? You know, his podcasting business is very interesting. He was there with the two people he'd founded it with, and probably two-thirds of the questions were about it, and it you know, it is very interesting what he's done there. I also found it very interesting that, you know, most of his podcasts are by his friends, like Alistair Campbell, Marina Hyde, and obviously he has too. So I think after our back and forth, I was just stewing. I've been stewing about him for a long time, as have many people in the Jewish community, as you know. So I was just stewing, and everyone applauded him. At one point he did say, well, not everybody likes me, not even in here, or there are some people that hate me. And I think he looked at me, but the person next to me said, I don't hate you. So I think he must have been looking in my direction.
Yes.
I mean, the way I was sitting, it was a kind of L shape. So actually, if I sat in a bit, I don't know whether he would have seen me, but maybe he was looking out for me. But he was, there were 25 journalists, and about, you know, him and his execs, there were about 28 of us. So he may well have noticed, and certainly... I was sort of sitting at the table because I'd ordered a drink and it had come late. So I was just finishing my drink, packing up my bags to go and write my story, which was going to be about, you know, what he'd said about the BBC. And then he came to talk to me, and he said, what's wrong? And I was, you know, when you have like a million things that you've been thinking in your head that you would say to someone if you got to talk to them, and suddenly there they are.
You rehearsed this moment for years and then it suddenly appeared.
It's kind of like where to start. So I said, you know, you're acting like an anti-Semite. You haven't tweeted about the hostages once. You know, that's what I'm thinking about. It's you're only ever one-sided. How can you possibly say that you're neutral? So that, you know, and then I said, I'm thinking about the women that are still being raped, the hostages, because I've been interviewing loads of hostage families. I've interviewed two parents of girls that are still in Gaza. And I've been kind of at the forefront of kind of helping to make sure that their stories are being told. I've been really disappointed by the women's groups in this country that have ignored that whole situation. So after I said, I'm thinking about the women being raped in Gaza, he went, I'm thinking about the dead children. And then he just went, I just want peace, and kind of put his hands out like in a peace way. I was like, well, we all want peace. But I just said, you know, there was peace up until the 7th of October. There was a ceasefire. I said, well, it's more complicated than that. I'm like, yes, there is the Palestine-Israel conflict. Then there is also Iran. It's a really complicated situation. But Hamas started this. I said, you never write about, you know, you never tweet about what Hamas does. It's always ever one-sided. And then I said, I don't think you understand the power that you have. You have 9 million followers. There are 270,000 Jews in this country. You are so much more powerful, and you never, ever say anything about that, about what we're going through too.
That's actually what got me blocked. I said, you have a responsibility to social cohesion, because he was tweeting very similar things during the last Gaza war in the spring of 2021, around the time of the megaphone gang down Finchley Road. Yeah. And I asked him to kind of think about it, put a sock in it, and that is when we fell out. And it's a shame because I worked with him many, many years ago. Whether he remembers that or not, I don't know. But we did a pilot show together on the BBC in the days when it was Gary and Sue, and they picked up the young buck from Talk Radio, which was me at the time, and we did a show together. You say at the end of your article, and well done for writing it so clearly, is that you don't think he's an anti-Semite, but it's almost certain that he's an anti-Zionist, and we know those things are similar.
It's so hard to say whether someone's an anti-Semite, and of course there is a kind of legal aspect. I don't think he thinks he hates Jews, you know, a bit like Corbyn too. You know, and he did talk about how his Jewish friends had talked to him about being upset with the anti-Semitism.
Well, so that's a revelation. He's got Jewish friends.
Yeah, well,
who stuck with him?
Well, Robert Paston's probably one of his mates. And it was very interesting. I don't know if you saw, there was a Guardian article with Gary that he referred to a few times. Well, you know, I did say it was terrible about October 7 in the Guardian article. And I kept saying, yes, but you haven't tweeted about it. You know, and of course, that was written by Charlotte Edwards, who is Robert Paston's girlfriend. And he does mention some Jewish friends in there, and he does mention the fact that some of them are unhappy with what he's been tweeting. So he does know. But I think it was interesting that he came to talk to me in different ways, and he wanted to shake hands at the end. And I wonder if there's just an element that he doesn't like the idea of not being liked and of actually being confronted by someone. I'm not very powerful, but I suppose I'm a journalist, so I have a voice. And of someone explaining that, even though he's, yeah, I know what it's like to get lots of hatred on social media, because so I wrote this piece first for the Jewish Chronicle and then did a version for the Daily Mail. When the JC went, you know, it went a bit viral, and then Owen Jones tweeted about it. So of course, then I got a massive pylon from people calling me Nazi and calling me this and that, sending me pictures of dead babies. So I can understand maybe not, you know, maybe just wanting to mute or block things out. And I'm sure he probably gets it in a greater degree than I do, because he has more followers, but substantially more.
Look, you gave him a guide as well. You said, you know, how can I deal with this? And you said, well, why don't you start tweeting about the hostages? Yeah. I mean, that's a very, very sage piece of advice from experience, and indeed from a point of decency.
Well, I mean, maybe the fact that he would struggle to even do that says something, doesn't it? You know, as you say, there are these people that are pulling things down because they don't want to believe it. They see it as propaganda, even though Hamas have put out videos of them, as we know. And I was at a press conference with two of the families, you know, and one of the families, and I've actually been to their house in Israel and interviewed them there. This woman and her two brothers have been held hostage. One of them, Hamas put out a video of three people. He was one of them and said, what happened to them? We'll tell you in 24 hours. And it was like a whole, you know, it was like a sick game show element to it. And then the next day they showed that two of the people out of the three were dead. And they showed kind of close-ups of their dead bodies. So Hamas are showing this, even though everyone wants to pull down these posters because they can't face it. But you know, when Israel does bad stuff, I do show some of it. I've written articles attacking Netanyahu's government. It's not like you have to see things in black and white, and I think that's the problem. If you see the world in quite a simplistic way of aggressor and victim, this is one of the problems, and this is why people are pulling things down, because they're so used to seeing Israel as the aggressor that they don't know what to do with themselves when Israelis are the victims. But if he had any care about showing nuance or any sort of understanding that it's a complicated situation, then he could just post a hostage video.
Are you playing catch-up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests. How about Douglas Murray?
Israel is a rare country in the West in that it does buck many of the trends. I mean, there isn't a fertility rate problem in Israel. For instance, as there is in most European countries, there is a strong feeling from nationhood and of the depths that the country needs to call upon in order to unite its people.
And Hillel Noyer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
Indeed. And of course, I think what people outside of the Jewish community and indeed supporters of Israel don't understand, that whoever was prime minister, they would do this. This isn't a Viktor Orban sort of prime minister retaliating in an overtly anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab way. This is the leader of a very unified country who, almost to a man and woman, support this campaign because they understand that it is existential.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, I think in some ways this was the most offensive thing that he said to me, which was, you know, I feel sorry for the Jewish people that because of Netanyahu's actions, they're getting all this anti-Semitism. And I tried to explain to him that no one, like every leader in Israel would be the same, whether it was the left or the right, that, as you said, Israelis are united. I spent a few days there in December, and after all of the disunity that there'd been just a few months before, everyone, as you say, existential. And also, they're in the Middle East. You can't just play nice. Hamas have said we're going to kill you all. Hamas showed we're going to how they will do it. And then if Hamas don't do it, then their big brothers, who are much more frightening, and of Hezbollah and people like that, then they're going to get involved. So you have to show that you'll calm down tough, because this is the Middle East and this is the world. This is how, you know, this is how war works. And I said to him, look at the numbers. If 6,000 people, the equivalent, if 6,000 English people had been murdered and 1,000 English people had been abducted, do you think we would do nothing? And that's when he said, well, you know, we didn't start bombing Dublin, did we? And which is something that I've certainly seen on social media, and I'm sure you have, that people just equivocating this situation, which isn't at all the same. You know, as I said to him, the IRA weren't running Dublin. They hadn't vowed to kill all the Protestants. So it's not the same situation at all. And this is the Middle East.
Do you think he searched you out because now he finally realizes that beyond his bubble, there is an existential threat, talking of that term, to his career, that he is sailing close to the wind? It would be very simple for him to do a hostage moment. It might be a bit cynical given the rather public row that is spiraling a little bit out of control, I think, which you have started, which is all to your credit. But he has other ambitions beyond the BBC, and he doesn't want to be too toxic. He must see now and understand that from a kind of financial point of view, that he is reviled by quite a large number of people.
No, I don't think so at all. Really? Because I think he's surrounded by people that all think like him. And also in terms of financially, I think his business is in a very healthy state. You know, that's part of what we were there to talk about, that his podcasts are some of the biggest in the country. They're all doing very well. There's only one that it sounded like that's not making money, which is a Sherlock Holmes kind of vanity project, which is one of his colleagues' ideas. that, you know, they're all doing really well. And he's got, I think actually it's more a kind of smug arrogance, which we see with quite a few people at the BBC, you know, that they think they're right. They will not listen to anyone who says you are wrong. They won't listen to the argument. We saw it a bit with John Simpson, didn't we, with the whole whether to call Hamas terrorists or not, where, you know, he was coming out with this, you know, pontificating excuse why you wouldn't call terrorists terrorists.
Do you think this is a design fault of the progressive thinking, the idea that we're trying to reach for a more perfect world, and anyone who stands in the way of this vision of the perfect world, the perfect arc, is actually some kind of heretic, is completely wrong, is a racist, or is against the sort of ideas that we so firmly believe in? It is actually a design fault of the progressive thinker, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a world that sees the world in terms of victims and aggressors. And it was something that really, yeah, came to me. Well, it was something that was mentioned to me when I was writing about the rapes of the Israeli women and the fact that they've been ignored by women's groups here. And I spoke to a Jewish woman who works in women's groups who said, was telling me how horrendous it is and the anti-Semitism that she's seen. And she said, you know, because particularly in their world of domestic violence, there is an aggressor and there is a victim, and that's easy, and it's not complicated. But that is the worldview. And it's so simplistic, it's unbelievable. Because you don't have to, you know, you don't have to pop out of your head out of your door for more than a few seconds to realize that life is complicated. There's nuance, there's history, there's different personalities, there's so many different facets that create war and history. And actually, you know, look, a lot of Gary's you know, best broad podcasts, they're historical, they're about politics, so you know, really he listens to his podcasts, so you would think that he would listen to learn a bit about the complexity of the world, and that it's not a story of right and wrong always, but, you know, shades of grey.
Nicole, this is the second time you've appeared on my podcast, Johnny Gould's Jewish State. I'm just sorry that it's about the same subject. It was about him, about the BBC 30s Germany jibe and how Match of the Day got taken off.
And of course, that's the irony, isn't it? That he wrote about the hate marches. These are not hate marches. It's not a hate march to march for peace. There are people on these marches that are actually saying the same things as the Nazis did in the 1930s, and he's applauding that. So that's why we were annoyed at that time, because he was kind of ignoring the Jewish element of what the Nazis had done. And this is what he's doing again. It's like he is blind to it. And you know, and this is something that we see on the progressive left, that Jews can't be victims because we are too white, we are too wealthy, we are too this, we are too powerful. And of course, that's all fed into by tropes that are so common in Western society, and even the liberal society, perhaps even more so, that they believe these things, that we are white and powerful, and that we are somehow immune to anti-Semitism, which, you know, suddenly that anti-Semitism has disappeared even. Or the worst thing, that we are, it's disappeared apart from among the right wing, and that by calling it out on the left and weaponizing it, then we are actually crying wolf and making it harder for those good people who want to help us to call it out when it's real anti-Semitism.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, you said, I'm still smarting about this, I'm still upset, I'm still sort of crying inside. I mean, days later, how do you feel about it? Are you a bit more satisfied that you took him on, and that you may have laid a glove on him to make him think a bit more?
Yeah, and I mean, what I wrote was that I was still shaking, because I came out of the room, and I phoned my editor at the JC, because I was, you know, I'd promised him that I would give them what lines came out of it. And then I said, well, you won't believe what just happened. And he was the one that actually said, I think that should be what you write about the encounter. And I was just still a bit shaken, because it was quite a, it was a, it was a, I, the way I've discussed it with you is as a discussion, but it was more of a row really. And people were trying to pull him away from me. And, you know, credit to him that he did say, no, it's fine. Because actually, I think he, you know, he ended up staying much longer than he was meant to. And we were probably talking for a good 5-6 minutes. But it's quite scary when you confront someone, when, you know, when you have a row with anybody, let alone one of the most famous faces in the country. So that's what how I was feeling when I was writing it. Now I feel I've had some amazing messages from Jewish people from... I've had hundreds and hundreds, and that's been really lovely. People have said, thank you for speaking for us. I think so many people were frustrated with him. And, you know, that includes I've had famous people messaging me too. A lot of people, I think, wanted to say what I said to him. And although, you know, sometimes I feel like I probably could have said it in a better way because, you know, I wasn't prepared to really be having that discussion with him. I hopefully some of it went through. If nothing else, at least I did tell him that if you're retweeting someone with a triangle in their Twitter, then that means they're pro Hamas, which he didn't.
And at least he hasn't put one in himself now, so that's a bit of a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Nicole, well done, and thank you very much for explaining that, because I've been going around podcasts in recent episodes to try and explain the psychology of the other side, and you've done that with great gusto. You're very brave. I know I speak for many of our listeners and viewers on this, so thank you very much for what you did, and thank you very much again for joining us here on Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you.
There's a lot of competing attention for you, I do know. You're probably consuming more media than ever before to be right up to speed with what's going on in Israel and back home. I'm playing my part in the best way I can, using my journalistic and production skills to make the case for Israel via this, Johnny Gould's Jewish State, and I've done it since 2018. If you enjoy my podcast, and you'd rather it existed than not, that I kept doing it, you can support me very simply by buying me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Johnny Gould, because it really helps. Tell your friends, subscribe now if you haven't already, scroll back and look through the 120 previous episodes. And as always, thank you for listening.